Welcome to Writers on Writing. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here every Wednesday evening from 6:30 to 7 with authors, editors, agents, poets, those connected with the art or business of writing. Tonight my guest is Los Angeles poet Eloise Klein Healy. She is chair of the MFA in Creative Writing Program at Antioch University, Los Angeles, the author of 4 books of poetry and a chapbook. Ms. Healy is also the associate editor, poetry editor of the Lesbian Review of Books. She's received fellowships from Dorlin Mount Colony, the McDowell Colony, and the California Arts Council. Her most recent collection, Artemis in Echo Park, was nominated for the Lambda Book Award in Poetry. In 1992, she was selected as the grand prize winner in the Los Angeles Poetry Festival, and in 1996 she was chosen by the Pasadena City College Literary Magazine as Poet of the Year. Her work has been widely anthologized in collections, which is where I discovered Eloise many years ago in an anthology called The Geography of Poets. Welcome, Eloise. Are you there?
I am.
It's so great to have you on the air.
Just been hanging out listening to music.
Eloise, how did you become a poet?
Well, I think probably a lot of it has to do with having a lifelong interest in words and, you know, not just what they mean, but what they sound like. Having an idea that words were somehow important. I mean, I remember when I was little, the thing that I wanted to do the most was to learn to read. And the idea of going to school was so thrilling to me because I thought, oh, I'm finally going to learn handwriting. And I knew how to read before I went. But just that whole world of that transformative relationship between real things and what we call them was just always, like, the most exciting thing to me. So it probably had a pretty early start that way.
Interesting. Were you attracted to other writing forms?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I first started writing in high school, I didn't write poetry, really. I wrote stories and I wrote essays. And I think I really didn't start doing poetry very much until I got into college. And I think probably at that point, having a lot more exposure to different kinds of poetry, I became much more interested in it and really focused myself on poetry much more in college, except I did write for the paper, and I did have a column in the student newspaper, but my main interest was poetry.
Mm-hmm. Will you talk about ongoing themes in your work?
Well, it's interesting that, you know, when you were introducing my work, you talked about that anthology called The Geography of Poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was getting my stuff together to think about what I might want to read tonight, I noticed that often I do write about places and things that happen in places and the influence of place on people. You know, my last whole book, Artemis in Echo Park, was really about the Southern California region and how landscape affects people, how we kind of live in our skin, both intellectually and emotionally and psychically, and that landforms and weather and the way we are in the outside is really very much influential on how we are in the inside.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people talk about it all the time. In other ways, you know, they talk about how, quote-unquote, California is so laid back. Well, I think one of the reasons why people say that about us is that there's very little difference here between being inside and outside.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever been in eastern states in the winter, but just getting outside is a whole ritual.
It's an ordeal.
Yeah. You know, it takes you 10, 15 minutes to get dressed and then to get undressed when you go from one place to another. And I think that kind of flow that's always available to us in the landscape produces certain psychic states.
Mm-hmm.
We are laid back in that way. And I don't know, I mean, I think there's a pejorative sense to it sometimes, but in a way, the way you are in the world is also the way you are in your head.
Mm-hmm. How true.
Yeah. Sometimes it's kind of not so good, but other times it's great.
Would you read something for our listeners?
Sure. Let me see. Where might I start? Why don't I start from something about place?
Yeah.
Well, place figures. This is a poem. It's very short. In fact, it's kind of an anomaly for me because lately I haven't been writing poems that are very short. But I did take a trip to China. And I went out to Xi'an, which is a well-known archaeological site, a major archaeological excavation is at Xi'an, and probably most people now are familiar with the stone statues of men and horses that were buried there. I mean, it's just huge. And this was a poem that's just kind of a little tiny snapshot.
Okay.
It's called Xi'an, Statues of Men and Horses. Standing in Xi'an, where they were buried, waiting like shells under the surface of an ocean floor, then uplifted to be carved down by eyes that river until, look, the centuries wear away, and they stand as before, an army of men and horses blinking in the sun.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting what you were saying about place, because I think back when I saw that poem of yours that I keep bringing up, I remember back then place was very important. I'd never been to California. Mm-hmm. I think I probably read that or got
where
that.
Where were you?
Well, I was in Vermont, I think, going to school. And or at least I'd never really spent time in Southern California at that point. And I just felt that poem really must be how it was, you know, L.A. versus San Francisco.
Right.
And I think a lot of the poetry I am attracted to, now that I'm thinking about it, is about place and what people do with that, what poets do with that.
Well, I think also... one of the things that we forget as Americans is how big this country is and how many regions we cross over. So let's say that if you looked at the national literatures of European countries, you have France, England, Italy, all in the same space as what we call the United States, geographically speaking. And yet we often try to think of a national literature that's somehow unhooked from where we are, whereas we have so many places that we live in. I think we probably would do well to think of ourselves as having a richness of location to talk about. But it's hard to get people to think that way. Because there's this notion that, well, there's American poetry.
Yeah.
But I think poetry that comes out of the South, or poetry that comes out of the Northeast, or poetry that comes out of the West, really has a lot of different elements to it. And instead of saying, oh, we can't deal with that, I think we ought to relish the kind of regional diversity that's out there.
Yes. Do you have a favorite poem or series of poems that you've written?
No, I don't, and I'm sure that raises the question of what shall I ask her next.
No.
You know, it changes over time. I mean, I have poems that I really love, and they mean more to me maybe than others, or maybe they might even mean to other people. I do have a poem about Los Angeles that I like. And maybe I could read that, because it's also kind of place.
Okay.
Los Angeles was founded on September 4th, 1871. And that's kind of like the official date, if there's ever an official date. But September 4th is also my birthday.
Ah.
So this poem is called Los Angeles is a Virgo. And it's kind of a long poem, I hope.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, it's kind of fat and long. And I have dedicated this poem to my friend Luis Alfaro, who is very interested in food, and this talks about food a lot.
Okay.
Los Angeles is a Virgo. The eternal child is what the magazine horoscope says, ruled by Mercury, born like me on September 4th, a little older, a little dustier, maybe even more varied than the crenellations in my cerebral cortex, more full of running glyphs than the convoluted cranial bag and fits of starts I've been juicing around in since I had my own little 9-4 entrance into the world of things and beings. No wonder I love this city, song of myself. Choose between little corner taquerias and Thai home cooking joints. Amazing as the expectations of angel sightings we daily live in, tongues of flames leaping not from the heads of gods or laps of goddesses, but from the green and red and yellow chilies swirling in the devil's bruise along the boulevards. Little corner parking lots with 4 or 6 paint stripes spots to slot a car into, then walk to the order window, pay, and move quick time into the takeout window line, pick up food here station, the sliding glass door ring with salsa cups, straws in white paper sleeves, chili flakes in a shaker, or what do you call this condiment of the culture from which this food is delivered and delivering us unto? Oh, the tongue is so much wiser than the mind. Shrimp burritos. Now, where did they come from? Fish tacos. It took me a long time to imagine them without conjuring up the image of a mermaid in a blanket. I would pass up a trip to Chasen's if some local loco could lead me to the right Cambodian market, Kum Cafe, and point out the fish sauce that would light up my lips like neon without putting me in a coma. I am immoral in my desire to roll around in my mouth, sniff the length of, and rub between my fingers the flavors, bread things, and common seasonings of all my compatriots here at the blue-bleeding westward sea shelf of the Pacific, where the currents of human traffic move and cut into each other like vast, mile-wide streams of water streaking toward the poles, weaving into the web of cloud, wind, and weather systems which billow into space like gossamer skirts, like a dancer's pantaloons, like the blue tattoo of the rivers of the earth coming into view through the cloud veil, which daily swings in and out over Mother Sea, over Mother Hand Me Over, Mother Carry Me On. Here's the common culture the anthros are looking for. When I try to order in my homegrown white girl Spanglish, hoping that when they call my numero ocho y something, because I'm bad at numbers in any language, I'll pick up my own order, and not some other mother tonguer's posky Y-rub strewn Dagwood 7-story-high sandwich to go with a handy wipe and pink Pepto-Bismol triangle in the bottom of the bag. And off I'll go, swirling into the traffic, lunch in lap, knowing I have 3 days to finish all matters related to communication, since my ruling planet and that of my hometown is taking off backwards, that old Mercury retrograde motion, for 3 weeks. A little planetary hiccup, hometown and I are both fabulously famous for. I told you it was long.
That's great. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest is Eloise Klein Healy, author of Artemis and Echo Park and many other wonderful poems. Are you from here? Are you from Southern California?
No, actually, I was born in El Paso, Texas, only because my mother was there. My mother was there because my father was there. It was 1943, and he was about to be shipped off for duty in the Army in World War II. So she had gone down to be with him before he left, and I was born, and then 6 weeks later he left and was gone for 2 years. He was in India and Burma. So my mom went back to South Dakota where she was from. My mom was from South Dakota. My dad was from Iowa. And then when he came home, we moved to Iowa. I lived until Iowa until I was 10. So I really think of my childhood as being kind of in a rural, small town setting.
Mm-hmm.
And then adolescence onward in a major urban, suburban world.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to read that poem? It's in the beginning of Artemis and Echo Park, and it's about your father coming home And You're a Little Baby?
Introductions? Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's a wonderful poem.
Okay. This was actually a poem that came out of an exercise in a class that I was taking when I got my MFA degree.
Uh-huh.
And at the, you know, the underlining, the undergirding structure of this poem is different time zones.
Uh-huh.
So maybe people could listen for the time zones as well.
That was the exercise?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
To take something but write about it from different time zones.
Okay.
This is called The Introductions. One, he is my daddy, and I am going up in his arms. The coat he wears is gruff, and I am a puffy baby in a snowsuit, my new suit. There is a spin of light and there is a blur of light and scary spin as I rise along the trunks of his legs and the branches of his arms to the cliff of his chest. My daddy. I am turning from him to find my others in the circle. When I turn again, his face scratches my cheek. My mother is crying, "That's your daddy." The thick green army coat, who has lifted me, who is holding me, who has glasses like my mother, and the little circles of light shine back at me. He is ours, they say. He is mine, my daddy. Two. That light in the stairwell, I could see it from my crib. It was alone with me, sometimes at my feet, sometimes rising up over my arm as I turned. What I learned first before speech was close and far in the form of light. How close? How far? Every grown-up day, that's the question. Alone sometimes, sometimes turning to another, that old feeling I can't talk about. How close? How far? Three. In my family, nobody talks about what's outside the circle. What's inside has been decided secretly, and an animal is born in me when I try to confide my feelings. Its chest heaves with a human sound, a nervous cough at what might be found out and how close it is to speech. Soon I will have something to say. My father will have to hear. He will feel a blow to his chest. He will blink his eyes at me, disbelieving. Someone should have prepared him as they prepared me. She's your baby. Four. All these friends of mine, these unmarried women my father wonders about, I'm always surprised he doesn't know their names after all these years, nor does he know them as lovers, mine and each other's, nor the way these shades of feeling shift and create family circles, traveling bands. Sometimes I imagine us on the frozen tundra, a place like Lapland, and we are bundled in our tribal gear, pushing through the eternal winters of our years. I will tell him about this life of mine, the scenes along the way, and how I am among my kind, a shuffling she-bear, trail-crashing omnivore looking for a fat trout, a sweet of berries, a deep, warm pocket to put my coat in for a long season. No, that's interesting. This is a poem from Artemis and Echo Park, and one of the things about this book is also to talk about animal life.
Mm-hmm.
I was particularly interested in talking about animal life in an urban setting. And the goddess Artemis has as her totem animals bears and dogs. And I threw in cactus because I thought that was I thought that would kind of fit. But I had forgotten that there was a bear in here, the shuffling she bear, who eats everything that comes along. That's a hard poem to read. My dad died 4 years ago, and I'm. You know, over the course of time, I have been learning more and more things about how he functioned in my creative life. So, you know, it's an interesting thing about poems. They're one thing, and then they're another thing, and then 20 years later, they're another
thing.
There's
something else.
Yeah, I think poems are developmental markers. You know, you can read a poem when you're 21, and you read it when you're 42, and it's a different poem.
Mm-hmm. How do poems come to you? Or
how do they?
Yeah, how do they come to you? Or is it all
variety.
Different ways?
You know, there are a variety of ways. One good thing for me is to get on an airplane. I immediately have 1,000 ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of poems come out of daily life. You know, like, I think like anybody else, you go walking down the street or you're at the market and boom, you have a little realization.
Mm-hmm.
Something happens. Pieces come together. Your experience, your wonder, just what a gesture that somebody makes, it has meaning. And one struggles to find out what that means.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of what a poem is. Oh, let's see here. I had a poem I was going to read about that. Uh-oh. It was one of those things about, kind of the immediacy
mm-hmm.
of something. But I think as we were talking, I turned the page and perhaps no longer right up on the top here.
Do you think that it's...
Ask me something else.
Do you think it's important for a poet in training to have the knowledge of the different types of poems, the, you know, iambic pentameter, mm-hmm. just all the different aspects
like
of writing.
Formal and
yeah.
poems, technical
haiku, all of that, even if what they end up writing is free verse?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's like, let's say you wanted to change the oil in your car, and you wanted to do that all the time. Probably would be a good idea to look at the diagram that comes with your car
mm-hmm.
that says, here's how you change the oil. Only because... And this is kind of simplistic, but only because a whole lot of people have changed oil before.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that a whole lot of people have written poems before, and there are a whole number of ways you can do it. And there's no one way that's sacred, but it's good to know that there are a lot of different ways you can approach it, because sometimes you have a subject, you're struggling with it, you don't know what shape it should take. And so you might say, I'll try this as a sonnet. I'll try this as a haiku.
Mm-hmm.
I'll try this in free verse. I'll try this in four-line stanzas. And, you know, one of those things may produce the poem.
Mm-hmm. So do you wait?
I found that poem.
Oh, go ahead. Read it.
Kind of immediacy kind of thing.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Called Peter Reads Me a Poem. And this is basically just something that happened, but it struck an idea.
Mm-hmm.
Peter reads me a poem on the phone, and I'm flying. He reads me a poem, and I'm trying to sound focused, but I'm flying out the door into the day. Still, I'm trying to listen to the which, the when, the why, the where. I'm trying to let everything come in. All of poetry, the future, the present, the past. And the poem has, no denying, flown into the face of my crazy fears, rearranging the sound of my heart to beat exactly like a sonnet by Ted Berrigan.
Hmm.
Now, I say that is totally a poem of the moment
mm-hmm.
and of associations.
Mm-hmm. It almost has the rhythm of the moment, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are other poems that aren't that way, and there are other topics that aren't that way. And if you tried to put certain topics into that form, it wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think poetry is a whole lot about trying to learn to fit things to their proper rhythm. I mean, even free verse has rhythms. You know, that was one thing that Ezra Pound said that was really smart. It isn't that free verse says you throw away metrics. It simply says you don't use traditional metrics, but you try and find the music of the subject.
Hmm, that's interesting.
So it isn't like we're throwing away music.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think, you know, that's one of the continual secrets of poetry, that it reveals how much music is in language.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of music in that little Peter Reads Me a Poem.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're at the end of our time.
Oh, I always, didn't I tell you?
I always dread this moment.
It was going to just fly by.
I dread it.
Yeah.
Do you have advice or words of wisdom or anything you'd like to especially pass on to the people listening who may be struggling with writing poetry or who may want to do that?
Well, first of all, keep your day job. But, you know, I would go back to the old advice about poetry that Keats said. And Keats said, poetry is a veil of soul-making. You know, you need to do poetry because you need to do poetry.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to do poetry because you need to buy a new car. It's really that you like language, and you like to think about things in language, and you like to put things down in words. And I think it's really important to do that and to honor how many other people have done that by reading what they write, by using those things for your own edification, by not being impressed by who's a famous poet as opposed to who's not,
mm-hmm.
but kind of making your way and doing a lot of writing. I would say anybody who wants to be a poet seriously needs to just at least read or write an hour a day for starters. You know, novelists, they have to do 4 hours a day, but poetry is a little bit more concentrated in certain ways, and
yes.
I would say you just make your way by doing it and exercising that muscle.
Well, Eloise Klein Healy, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, no problem.
It's really been wonderful.
Thank you, Barbara.
I really love your work, and thank you.
No problem.
Okay.
I hope we get to see each other.
That would be nice.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Next week, I'll have an extended broadcast from 5:30 to 7 p.m. My guests will be Patricia Guyver and Danny Shapiro. It'll be a great show, so tune in. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett at KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. If you have any comments about Writers on Writing, email me at bdemarcob@aol.com. Thanks for listening and get to work. Remember, it's all about writing like there's no tomorrow.